Hi, I'm Taylor Smurl, and I'm an experienced bartender.
And I'm Tommy Smurl. I'm an experienced drinker.
He's my dad, and together this is...
Neat! A weekly booze cast.
With history lessons, trivia, and a twist.
So pull up a stool to the bar and join us for the lowdown on your highball.
Hello again, Dad.
Well, hello there, Taylor. Good to see your bright, smiling face.
Good to see you, too. Have you been? You had a good week?
Yeah, it's been a pretty good week. Can't complain. Got some cleaning done around the house. So, you know, that's always good when we do that yearly adventure.
That's just the one time a year. That's all you got to do.
No, it's the only time I find a spare moment of about once a year.
Are the Christmas decorations down?
Rid of those the weekend after Christmas.
I put my, this was the first year I had a Christmas tree. It was artificial, but I put it away before New Year's. It was away and down by like the 28th, and I didn't know how to feel.
Yeah, we took all the outdoor decorations down on the Saturday. Christmas was on Friday, so Saturday we took down the outside stuff, and Sunday took down the inside stuff.
That is the most ahead of it that I think, because I feel like I've seen y'all leave them up till January.
Yeah, that's happened. Yeah. Now that was when we had a real tree. It was always more of an ordeal taking down the real tree because you left the blanket of green needles through the middle of the living room.
Yeah.
And if you remember there on Belmont, I had to drag it out that side door and it never fit. So it snapped off branches and more needles. And then I had to drag it up the hill to throw it away up in the woods.
That's right. Yeah. In my childhood home, we had woods behind our house and there was like a Christmas tree graveyard out there.
Yeah.
Of all of our Christmas trees with like some errant tinsel still sticking to it. Yeah. That was quite
every once in a while, you'd find a stray ornament that got missed that was still hanging on one up there.
just a little elf that lives in the woods now. Well, you know, you got to jump on spring cleaning. We'll just look at it that way. We're almost there, right? I like to round up this time of year. It's basically February, which is basically March, which means it should be warm soon, right?
Yeah. Well, here's the thing that gives me hope. I've got to do my payroll taxes, and I have to submit them in through a thing that you call in and go through an electronic process, and they take the money out of a bank. And when you do it by the quarter. So when I go in and do the quarter, I have to put in either 03, 06, 09 or 12. So I'm doing 03. So I'm thinking, oh good, I'm on March. It's almost spring.
I feel like time is moving fast, which is weird. But I will welcome the spring. We haven't gotten the brutal cold up here yet. I feel like it always waits. It always waits until you're super like excited about spring. And then it's like the last weekend in February and it's just 8 degrees and blizzards in New York City.
Well, I was here last year. I don't even think we had spring. It was cold all the way up through May and then June hit and it was 85 degrees.
Oh, that's the worst. That's the worst because my favorite type of jacket is a light leather, fake leather, but like I like jacket weather. I like light jacket weather. I feel like it's my best style. It's my best, all my best looks, and they don't exist anymore. You go from summer to winter, you don't get fall, you don't get spring, and that's beautiful jacket weather. So who knows, maybe that'll be different if we eventually have some climate control happening, but who knows.
Well, if you are cold right now at this time of the year, I know something that could keep you warm.
There's the transition. Yes. Interesting because it is a beverage that's traditionally consumed very, very cold, and yet it is also consumed in very, very cold places. We are talking about vodka.
Vodka, the drink of the Russian people and its history. Part one.
Well, yes, as Dad just alluded to. So this episode was prompted by a question that I was sent in from Austin. Thank you, Austin. Austin's question was, I was thinking about this. Vodka is the traditional alcoholic beverage of Russia, but potatoes were only relatively recently introduced there. Is vodka a newish thing in Russia that just took over, or did Russians' love affair with vodka predate potato vodka? And I didn't know this answer off the top of my head, so I did some research. And in that research, I discovered that there is just so much in Russia's relationship with vodka. There's so much history. There's a ton of culture. There's a lot of fun superstition and tradition. So it really merited a two-episode situation here. So you got 2 weeks of Russian vodka coming at you.
Yeah, there was so much rich history in the development of it and how vodka was used throughout the Russian history that we just felt like that by the time we did that, we'd never be able to talk about current times. So
yeah,
that's the way we're going to split it up. This will be the historical episode, and the next one will be more current times and vodka in current day Russia.
There you go. So, you know, just to get right into it and to address part of that question, which I think is a great question about what is vodka made from, I want to briefly discuss what vodka is. Now, vodka, the word, it's actually a diminutive form of the Slavic word voda, which means water. And so in that sense, vodka is, you know, sort of little water. And that kind of works because its composition is intended in modern production to be just ethanol and water. There are a few remaining esters. Esters are just sort of flavor molecules, but ideally the construction of vodka is just ethanol and water. Now, I do think that this merits a bit of a discussion of how it fits into the world of base spirits, because outside of vodka, base spirits tend to be defined by one of two or both of the following qualifiers, and that's desired flavors in the glass or ingredients utilized in the production. So to kind of demonstrate this, like, let's think about gin for a minute. Gin can be distilled from many different sugar sources. You can make gin from wheat, from potatoes, from grapes. But the prominent flavor must be juniper for it to be considered gin. And it's defined by its botanicals. So it's defined more by its flavors than necessarily what it's distilled from. Now, opposite that, let's look at something like rum. Rum presents an entire range of flavors in the bottle. It can be smoky and, you know, structured like bourbon. It can be bright and dry and grassy, like, you know, like more botanical gins. It can be fruity and funky and sort of sweet like tequila. So rum can present itself with a lot of different flavors, but it has to be made from sugarcane or sugarcane byproducts, sugarcane juice, syrup, or molasses. So in that sense, the control mechanism of what defines rum is more about how it's made and less about the flavors in the bottle. And then you have something like bourbon, which sort of has both of those elements. Bourbon has to be made certain ways. It has to be made from at least 51% corn. It has a lot of controls there, but also with like the barrel finish that's necessary, that's imparting those barrel notes, those sort of smoky notes, the flavor also is expected. So when we talk about base spirits, we're usually talking about what defines them. We're talking about one of these two categories, if not both. Now, vodka's weird because vodka is literally defined by being made from anything and tasting like nothing.
Well, that's a great combination. Make it from anything and make it taste like nothing, and then you can call it vodka. That's a great marketing strategy.
That's kind
vodka,
of like
the drink that tastes like nothing.
Yeah, I mean, but that's the thing. Like, when people ask you, like, what defines a vodka? What is vodka made from? I mean, it's hard to really, because it's literally, you can distill vodka from any sort of grain. You can distill it from potatoes. You can distill it from honey. You can distill vodka from any plant-based sugar source, basically. Any starch that you can convert to sugar. So it can be made from many things, and then you distill it multiple times. Like, you know, you see that label on vodka that says triple distilled. What that means is that word I said before, the ester, that's just the flavor molecules that want to hang on to those alcohol molecules as they evaporate and condense in the distilling process. And so the more times you you heat and condense that ethanol, the more of those esters, the more of those flavor molecules are going to get left behind. So the cleaner product you have, the more pure ethanol you have. And so the goal of many vodkas is to just be, is to get rid of as many esters as possible.
Pure alcohol, pure ethanol.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, if you, and it's really the only controlling mechanism in vodka, and it depends on what part of the world you're in, but vodka has to be between like 30 to 40% or 37 to 40% alcohol. And all that means is it's how much water you're diluting your ethanol with. So if you don't dilute it, you have Everclear. If you took a bottle of Everclear and added some water to it, by effect, you've made vodka.
We never thought of adding water to our Everclear. We did add grape punch before.
Well, there you've got grape vodka. That's not usually how infusion works. But yeah. So just to sort of wrap your head around, like, what is vodka? It can be distilled from many things, and it's meant to taste like nothing. Now, this is the overarching idea of vodka for many decades, if not centuries. In modern times, it gets to be a little bit different, but we're not going to get to that in this episode. So for now, that's our kind of rough definition of vodka. It's sort of a blank slate. And that's, I will say, like, you know, in the world of bartending, a lot of bartenders sort of snub their nose at vodka, right? Like, it doesn't have anything to offer to a drink. Basing a drink in vodka is just, you know, having a drink that lacks all identity.
But some people, that's what they're looking for. They want a base spirit that's not going to mess up the other flavors they're looking for. And vodka is that invisible alcohol that you can make whatever you want and get drunk.
Well, I mean, that is actually a really good point, because that's, and I've worked with a few, I think some of the more talented bartenders I've worked with have seen vodka more as a blank canvas, where you can actually build more subtle, soft, nuanced flavor profiles because you're not working around very forward base spirit. You know, when we talk about base spirit, we say that because it's usually the biggest pour in your drink. And when you've got 2 ounces of, say, you know, like mezcal or funky rum, that's going to overtake most of the other ingredients in your drink. When you've got 2 ounces of vodka as your base, you can have a lot of conversations with your other flavors, and the vodka is just going to be a back note. It's just going to open things up the way that alcohol does on our tongue. It just kind of lets us taste things. So it is, I will say in my early days of bartending, I definitely was one of those like vodka cocktails. But I feel like there is a place for them, both in people that do just not want to taste things, and also in building really beautiful, subtle cocktails that don't necessarily have to be assertive.
Vodka, the invisible lubricant.
Sure.
Social lubricant is what I meant.
I mean, all right. Yeah, don't you, that's, it's fine as a social lubricant. Meet the Boozecast does not encourage any other form of lubrication that vodka will provide.
I meant socially. It breaks the ice, you know.
Yeah.
Loosens everything up. There you go.
Yep. There you go. All right. So that's vodka in the modern sense. Now let's talk about Russia and vodka specifically. Now, even before Russia had vodka, its history is kind of tied to drinking. And that's really what we're going to touch on repeatedly in this episode, is just how much of its history has tied to alcohol consumption. But going back to like the 10th century, you have Vladimir the Great, who kind of, I guess, bored with paganism, decided to shop around for a new religion for Russia. And he invited representatives from neighboring religions to kind of show him what they got. And he was turned off on like Islam and Judaism because they had an emphasis on sobriety. Certain forms of Christianity seemed like too much of a bummer. They didn't want to party. He liked Eastern Orthodox Church because they were down with drinking. And as he famously has stated, drinking is the joy of the Russians. So even in the shaping of Russia, alcohol was playing a part.
Any religion that you doesn't believe in drinking isn't a religion for me.
I mean, basically, well, we were Catholic, so I guess that's, you know.
They embrace drinking.
That's fine. It's not drinking. It's the blood of Christ. I'm allowed to drink as much of the blood of Christ as I want.
You just don't drink the blood to the point of drunkenness. That's all.
You know, this is an aside, but that is actually one of the ways that the Catholic Church got around prohibition, is because of, they said it would violate their religion to say that the wine that you consumed was anything but the blood of Jesus, and thus not alcoholic anymore if you consumed it in church. So they were one of the greatest producers of wine during prohibition, because they could say, we're not giving anybody wine. We're giving people the blood of Jesus. That's not alcoholic. But then they also had like several varietals that they would offer. So here's like a Riesling blood of Jesus. Here's like a Chardonnay blood of Christ. Anyway. All right. So the origins of who first made vodka are a little iffy. There are versions of its creation kind of arriving all at the same time around Russia. You know, you have Poland is finding its own form of vodka. You have the Chinese develop their own form of vodka. And a lot of these go back to like that aqua vitae, that spirit of life that's sort of been around for a while. But this all comes about the mid-13th century, if you want like a date. And now the Russian origin story, which, you know, conflicts with others, the idea of distilling spirits was first introduced in 1386 by a Genoese ambassador who was visiting Moscow in the court of Grand Duke Dmitry Donsky. This ambassador called his gift aqua vitae, or water of life, and it was distilled from grape must. That early distilled spirit was definitely much muddier, much lower proof than anything resembling modern anything distilled, but it was enjoyed by the court to the point that they wanted to figure out how to make it themselves. Now, legend continues that in 1430 or thereabouts, there was a monk named Isidore. He was actually Greek in origin, but he worked inside the Kremlin in the monastery there, and he made the first Russian vodka. So, you know, grapes were not a thing that you had in mass quantities in Russia, but you did have grains, so he distilled it from grains as the fermentable sugar source. And because it was distilled from grains, he called it bread wine.
Makes sense. Bread comes from wheat, so why not have your drink that you make be wheat drink?
There you go. It's your liquid, your boozy bread. And now, this was sometimes called polugar, which means half burnt. And that simply means that fermented liquid would be boiled down to like half its volume, and that would indicate that it was at its proper strength. And I do want to emphasize that this early Russian vodka, so to speak, would have been entirely different than anything that we have today. And its appearance is going to change pretty drastically in a couple centuries from now. We'll get to that in a second. But what you would have had is something that was very like bready, something very roasty. It is not attempting to filter out all of those flavors. It definitely would have tasted like something, and a little lower alcohol too. So in the first few centuries of vodka in Russia, you would have like had a whole range of these polugars available. Like they would have like a caraway polugar or a dill polugar or a garlic polugar, and each one would be used to like pair for different courses in a meal or for different occasions. So even though it all was sort of vodka, it had a lot of variants in it.
Now, would those have been more like moonshine that we've talked about before, when people do their own home brewing and stuff like that, so they added those different things, as opposed to like this that you were talking about there, where they were brewing it in the monastery or distilling it in the monastery, that, you know, that kind of rings bells with what was done with several different things like beers and others, that the church takes it over and they decide what it should be. But people that want to do their own because they don't want to pay for it, they do the different flavors.
Well, I mean, I think it was more at the time it was both, because you had... This was just the way that it would have been prepared. Like, you would have had it be it's similar to moonshine, and like, yes, there were lots of small independent producers of this at the time, but you also just had it was popular to drink it infused with many things. But yeah, so it definitely, like, it was, everybody would have had their own recipes for it, but there was, the characteristic of it was more varied, more unique, definitely more flavorful. I mean, at that point, you could almost consider it more in like the lines of like an aquavit or even gin. Realizing the power of vodka and how it can control people, how it could be used to get money for the state is going to be a consistent theme moving forward in Russian history, starting really with like Tsar Ivan III, also known as Ivan the Terrible. He established the first bread wine monopoly in the 15th century. So he set up state-owned taverns to dispense vodka, bread wine, distilled spirit, and that allowed much of the state to become indebted to him. Because you would, you know, go to these taverns, they would allow you a tab, but it was the only place you could really get booze. And you could just, you know, ring up that tab.
And up until the 18th century, almost all the vodka was being produced out of Moscow.
Hmm.
So, of course, that was their seat of power. And so they wanted to keep it there because they could control it better.
Well, now, like you were saying, like it was to the tavern owner's benefit to encourage drinking.
Yes, because they were paying the same price to Moscow. It's like, you know, currently in today's world, you have liquor licenses.
Right.
Well, in effect, they got the right to own one of these taverns and sell booze. So then in return, they had to pay the government a certain amount of money. And that money wasn't based on their sales like we base things on sales. It was saying, you owe us this much every month or whatever it was, regardless of whether you sell any or not. So these tavern owners were like, I'm going to sell all I can. So they wanted the cheapest vodka they could and to sell it, you know, as cheap as they could just to get it turned over and get as much sold as it could to try to make money.
Well, and you know, very different from, I think, a lot of the revolutions born in the tavern in other parts of the world. It was because these were state-owned, they purposely employed bar owners and workers that would, you know, espouse, like, loyalty to the government. It, you know, you would raise a toast to your government in
right.
your government-owned tavern. And that was part of working in those establishments was emphasizing loyalty.
Well, and the drinking of the vodka became like a national, not just loyalty, but you were supporting your government. You were helping your country succeed. So the more you drink, the more that your country was going to do better. So everybody went and you know, bought vodka. And basically, it was state, it was government-sanctioned alcoholism. They were driving their people to drink.
I mean, and you know, to be fair, also some more insidious leaders in Russian history used this not just on the general populace, but also in their own courts. I mean, Ivan also saw the power of insobriety. So to keep his like royal court sort of appeased and like not non-threatening, he would just keep them all very intoxicated. He purposely kept his courts very drunk. And that way they weren't going to fight back. And anybody that had any dissent brewing in them might spill that after a few too many. And that idea lives on throughout Russian government to come. Like, you know, you fast forward a few centuries later to Stalin, who notoriously would look as though he was drinking, but would stay sober and encourage those around him to drink to excess, in part to have them reveal themselves. So if there's dissenting opinions he had to get rid of, he could figure out who that was. Likewise, Russian Tsar Peter the Great. He was a big contributor to the popularity of vodka. He's also, you know, just anecdotally, he's the creator of the penalty shot concept, which if you arrive late to a party, you had to take a shot of vodka. That sounds fine, except for sometimes he would choose that penalty shot would come in the form of a 1.5 liter goblet that he named the Big Eagle. In fact, foreign dignities were so afraid of the amount of drinking that was encouraged in Peter the Great's court that they would often attend their parties with a backup, like a person that was basically their keeper, just in case they got so drunk that they passed out. They had someone there who could stay sober and discuss state affairs. And this was once again in order to get people to open up, to speak more plainly, and to reveal if they had any, you know, intentions.
Well, one of the things, too, that, you know, they were known for their, you know, prolific drinking of vodka, but, and they, you know, they drank a lot of it at a time, and part of it, they found later in studies, was based on their genetics.
Really?
Their genetics allowed them, like a lot of Europeans, that they slowly metabolize alcohol into the toxic chemical acetaldehyde, And that's what causes hangovers and unpleasant effects. So other cultures metabolize it faster, and it causes bad effects, so they can't drink it as much. But the Russians genetically can do it. So it said, you could say that the genes do not make Russians drink, but they allow them to do so. Mm. Actually, the word vodka was being used before it was actually attached to this beverage we now know as vodka.
Really?
It at the time was being used as referring to herbal tinctures similar to absinthe that contained up to 75% alcohol by volume. And the first time the word vodka was associated with this drink was by the Empress Elizabeth in 1751. And she used the term talking about the government's regulated vodka distilleries that they were running. And she called them vodka, and from there on, that word was associated with it. Before, it had several terms, such as the bread wine, like you talked about. But that's when it became the term vodka was used for that.
So it was sort of, do you think it was like a PR cleanup? Like, oh, it's vodka we associate with a health tincture, and now we're calling it vodka, so it's healthy.
Yeah, either that or they just decided, she decided that she wanted to be famous for something, so she's going to name what that drink was, because evidently there was a lot of people called it a lot of different things, so I guess they were producing the standard beverage, so they were going to give it a standard name.
Huh. Wow. Well, now, one thing that, a kind of important development, so, you know, we've gotten up to, like, roughly the 1800s here, and throughout, like, you know, the Russian government would keep, they would rescind it and reinstate this monopoly several more times, but the people in charge continued to understand the importance of alcohol and its revenue and its ability to control population. Now, this very important, if not a little depressing development to the flavor of vodka happens in 1884. So up till now, we're still dealing with this Polyar, this bread wine, which, you know, has this rich tradition of distilling. It has different characteristics. You know, you do see, like, more and more in the 19th century, the royal family started, like, selling exclusive rights to regions of production. So you kind of have these little, like, monopolies popping up everywhere. But we are still producing these traditionally made beverages. Now, in 1884, Tsar Alexander III, he bought 300 of the new French invention, their rectifying towers, their like more precise column stills, which could remove a greater number of esters, produce a more pure spirit. And depending on how you look at it, you know, did he do this so he could ensure that Russian vodka would be more pure, or did he do it just simply because it was an expensive thing that only he could get his hands on? In any case, he declared that the only real vodka that would be the national vodka would be this filtered, you know, ethanol content of 40% at least, more purified vodka that only he could make, and all other non-vodka spirits were illegal. So once again, putting the money back into the Russian government.
I make the rules and you will follow the rules. And by the way, I have the only machines that comply with the rules. So
I mean,
good fortune for me. Aren't I lucky? It just worked out that way.
That's the move. I realized that the stance I took on that was it's bad because it took the flavor away and not that it's bad because it's the government dominating the people. And I apologize for that. It's bad for both. Yes. Yeah, so this is really when you see vodka change from, while it was old, it had a long history of being a state-controlled commodity to produce money, it is now a identityless state-controlled product to produce money. So pretty much, you know, overnight, all of those little local backyard stills closed down, bread wine was lost, Polyar was lost, and you had this higher filtration, purer, quote-unquote, Russian vodka become the identity of Russian vodka. And I mean, you know, I mean, but whatever the case, it worked. Like, by the 19th century, a third of the country's operating budget was coming from alcohol sales and the taxes they collected. So it was a massive part of the nation's revenue was through alcohol.
So the government had a vested interest in you drinking and drinking heavily.
Yeah. I mean, and this goes right up to, like, you know, we're getting to, like, World War I territory, where Nicholas II, he saw 400 distilleries built and created under his reign. And you know, by then you had Russians drinking 14 plus liters of pure alcohol every year for the good of the state.
It was rumored that Peter the Great used to drink a half a gallon of vodka every day.
That's a lot of vodka.
I wonder what the Great was. He was the Great drinker?
I don't know. All these dudes are like, this dude's the terrible, this dude's the great. I don't know. They all did some pretty gnarly stuff. Yeah, well, and you know that they were this dedication that the Russian, you know, controlling class had relied upon for drinking by Russian citizens kind of bit them in the ass more than once, in that like Nicholas II eventually attempted a form of prohibition because he kind of saw how much it was degrading the Russian people, that it was leading to so much drunkenness, that it was leading to so much bad health. And that was one of the forces that helped power the 1917 revolution. So you really, this is the first instance of, oh wait, now you want us to drink less after encouraging us to drink more for your money? No, we're not having it. We're overthrowing your government. And that's really, now we're back to Stalin again. And Stalin encouraged drinking to excess. He liked the drunk populace. It helped support the government. It filled their coffers. But it also, most importantly, kept the people complacent. If you were drunk, if you had plenty of vodka, you weren't going to complain about how we were running things. And Stalin also employed vodka in another supposed historical event where, in World War II, Churchill was very against communism. He was very against Stalinism. He was not a fan. But after a long night of drinking with Stalin, he decided to form the Allied partnership with him. You know, I guess after having enough vodka, Churchill thought it was an okay idea.
Well, you know, there's a lot of events in history, I think, that have been changed with liquid into glass.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you go back to early American history is like just, you know, battlefields full of drunk people. When you look at like the alcohol ration of like, you know, the Revolutionary War or like the American Civil War, you just had drunk people fighting other drunk people. These amazing displays of courage were just, no, they were just children that had been given a pint of whiskey for breakfast.
Well, you know, but they actually told people that it had medicinal value.
Sure,
you know,
yeah.
That you weren't drinking it as an alcoholic. It was making you healthier. It said that many Russians ascribed to the medicinal, almost supernatural qualities of vodka. Parents would soak cotton balls in vodka and dab them on children to bring down a fever or ease an earache. Vodka with pepper was prescribed for an adult's cold. Vodka with salt for an upset stomach. And some nuclear scientists even drank it to protect themselves from radiation.
All right. Well, I don't, that last one I definitely doubt. But you're exactly, you're right. And then that's in those early days, like, you know, anything that those monks were distilling, that it was at least with the illusion of it was vaguely for health. And Russia did use vodka, did employ that bread wine initially as both, yes, it's tasty, yes, it's nice, but it's also good for you. Anything that, like, we're talking about distilled spirits or fermented spirits in the time when you still had, like, waterborne pathogens that you didn't understand, you can't really blame these people for feeling like this stuff made you healthier, because in many cases, quite practically, it did. It protected you from waterborne pathogens if you were drinking fermented or distilled beverages, because those could not support those pathogens.
Later, the Soviet state carried out several anti-alcohol campaigns, but they continued to sell alcohol, but they would just like decrease it to 5 hours a day. They would sell it and things like that.
Which would just lead to really long lines.
That's right. If you want it, you're going to be there during that 5 hours if you want it.
In the 80s, Gorbachev tried to also rein in alcohol consumption in the populace. He tried to make he mandated distilleries to make mineral water and fruit juice instead of alcohol. And raise the taxes on vodka. So The short-term effect was, very briefly, in the mid-80s, the life expectancy of your average Russian man increased by like 3 years. But that was a very short-term effect. The higher cost of alcohol, and then, of course, the growth of a black market where people could, you know, were basically bootlegging, backfired on the government. People just ultimately drank more imports and bootlegs, causing the Soviet economy to, it lended to their collapse because they didn't have this booze money anymore. People were drinking bootleg booze. They weren't any healthier, but the government just didn't have the money.
Well, they needed to think about that. If you know that 30 to 40% of your national income is coming from booze, you're going to suffer when you restrict booze.
I mean, you know, the same thing happened with Prohibition in the American economy. I mean, we were already so devastated at that point, but really, like, Prohibition in America, you can't really put the genie back in the bottle. I guess just because means of production in America weren't owned by the government and were owned by individuals, you just sunk a bunch of individuals with Prohibition. But, you know, ultimately, it's better to have something regulated and safe and legal than to try to make it illegal. Hey, what's up, weed legislation?
Oh, you're seeing some similarities, huh?
I'm just saying, you know, maybe like a poor state with a lot of natural resources, like, oh, I don't know, West Virginia could really rebound itself if it just had legalized marijuana and could produce it itself. I'm just saying, you know?
I mean, they're growing it and selling it anyway.
Exactly.
It's not doing it. It's not doing it legally.
Why not just make it a tourist destination? But yeah, you know, it wasn't until, and I don't really want to give any credit to Putin because it's Putin. But he is the first Russian leader to kind of impose taxes and production standards on vodka that actually caused the excessive drinking of Russians to start to fall without prompting revolt. And then that sort of brings us up to date. And I do, because I think along with that, to be honest, we're talking the modern era now. There are other things that factor into it. There is a worldliness that allows people to, you know, drink other things. There's more imports happening. So it's not just that taxes could finally be levied that caused people to drink less. It's actually just that people had a bit more understanding and freedom to drink other things.
Well, it's also the breakup of the USSR.
Yeah,
that had all the other countries that were involved there, and they were very insular, and they weren't going to import a bunch of beverages from other places. You were going to drink the fatherland's drink there, or motherland, whatever they go by, that you were going to drink what they had there, and as being part of a good you know, citizen of that country. So they were all there. Now that they're broken up into several different groups, and now that the borders are more open and there's more free trade, then there's more possibilities. But there for a long period of time, while it was the USSR, you just didn't have those kind of choices.
Yeah. Well, there was just so many of the distilleries were government owned. So whatever they were allowed to make, which was the Russian issue vodka, that's what you could drink.
Yeah. You know, one of the things I thought was funny that I wouldn't have thought of is that through the history with vodka being involved, one of the reasons that it was the main drink, too, is, you know, their weather is not very warm and sunny.
No, they are cold.
So they have a lot of frozen territory. Like, think about Siberia. So vodka is something that they can have that doesn't freeze on them. I mean, if you brew beer and leave beer sitting out on the front porch, you're not going to have any beer left. So it's going to freeze, but vodka doesn't freeze, so they could transport it around with relatively little care, and it would be all right.
I mean, that's true of a lot of high alcohol spirits, but there is definitely an association with being, even like, I don't want to get too much into like modern drinking habits, but there are a lot of bars that have opened up in New York that I've seen that are kind of novelty bars, like Russian vodka bars, where the point is, like, you go into a room made of ice and drink Russian vodka. Like, they'll give you a big furry coat and you sit inside and you drink Russian vodka in the cold.
Was that like the ice slew or whatever it is that drink Jägermeister down?
Ice luge. I mean, that's nice because it just, you get a shot of really cold spirit in your face. But this is like an actual room, like a walk-in freezer that they've covered the walls with water so they freeze, and you, they give you a big coat, and you go into this walk-in freezer and you pay to sit there freezing and drink vodka.
That would not make me happy. My joy in life comes from being warm, sitting on the beach with a drink in my hand, not in an ice cube.
I mean, but that's, I guess that's part of the experience. I don't know. And you know, and if that piques your curiosity, we will have more on, because I have a weird assortment of stories about Russian vodka bars in New York City that I will, I'm happy to share. But we'll talk a bit more next week about now the current, like, drinking culture in Russia. We'll talk about, you know, some of the superstitions, some of the traditions around drinking vodka around the world, and sort of, you know, what's the state of vodka consumption in Russia today.
All right. Well, that sounds good. Yeah, we're right into it. There was just too much information to just shortcut it all the way in. There was a lot of history that I didn't know was there, you know, that basically, it was state mandated drinking, and now we know why they, why vodka was a drink of choice. That was the one that the, that their basically government put out for years.
Well, and you know, it seems like a lot, but then I think if I then like think parallel, like, well, if I tried to make an episode about the importance of whiskey in American history and all the ins and outs of it, that's massive.
Like, true.
It's not, maybe it's not quite as in, once again, like, ensnared in the government, and that the government never owned the means of production of whiskey, but it's still massively important in the establishment and the growth of America. So I, you know, I realize now, you know, in retrospect, tackling a topic like this, of course it's massive, because so much of human civilization is tied into alcohol. And definitely if you go country by country, that's always true. So I'm excited, though. I love finding like wells of information where I kind of expected, you know, a little bit, and finding a lot. That's exciting to me.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, we probably just scratched the surface on the things that we were just to highlight things that caught our eye, and it's probably a whole lot more in depth than what we even touched on.
Absolutely. So we'll get a little bit more into it next week, but over on the video, we'll be, I don't know, what are we doing? We'll be doing some cocktails with some Russian vodka. There is actually traditionally made Polar at one of my liquor stores, that I can have access to. So I'm excited. I've never tried it before, but I will be able to try it on the video. So that'll be cool. So we will try real Russian bread wine, or rather I will try it. Dad will look on, sadly.
I'll watch you try it.
Dad will drink his Stoli while I drink my my Russian bread wine.
My Stoli and smoke my Stogie.
There you go. Are Stogies? I don't think Stogies are Russian.
No, I don't think so. It just sounded the same.
Stoli and Stogie.
See, I hear crazy things and I just say them. I don't know.
You gotta get one of those glasses to drink that. There are these glasses that are made that have like a little C shape cut out of the side, so you can fit a cigar in them.
Oh yeah.
I think it's a terrible idea, because then you just have a wet, soggy cigar, and a drink that tastes like cigar smoke.
I'm not much on the cigars or cigarettes or anything anyway, so.
No, I mean, same, but you know, I see those glassware on like drinky blogs all the time. Like, that's okay. That's a thought. Anyway. All right. So join us on the video. We'll be mixing up some drinks with some Russian vodka and trying some traditional Russian spirits. Join us next week for part two, where we talk more about the modern drinking scene in Russia. All right. So a little bit of housekeeping. If you want to find us on social media, if you want to tweet at us, or you want to find us on Instagram, we are NeatBoozeCast. If you want to email us, we are neattheboozecast@gmail.com. If you would like to join our Patreon, we have stickers and coasters depending on your tier, and you can ask us questions like this. So this was a Patreon member that asked us this question. You can have an episode themed around your question if you join our Patreon for as little as $1. You can ask us questions and have personal episodes. And of course, you can find us on Facebook.
Facebook. We have a Facebook page. Join the Neat group. We'll be glad to have you.
There you go. You can talk to Dad. Mano y mano. All right. Well, thank you, Dad, for joining me.
Well, thank you, Taylor, for having me.
All right. And thank you all for listening. I have been Taylor Smurl.
I've been Tommy Smurl.
And this has been...
Neat!
That was melodic. That was nice.
You know, here are some other fun facts that I didn't even throw out there. During World War II, the Soviet Union troops were given a ration of vodka every day. But you could save yours up to get it all like on a weekend or something like that.
Oh, yeah?
So they did that. And then after the Nazis surrendered to the Soviet Union in 1945, the Russians partied so hard, the entire nation ran out of vodka.
Wow.
They drank up the entire supply of
it. That's when you know you won.
Yeah. One time, vodka was given to two elephants that were stuck out in an ice storm. They were freezing, so they gave them vodka, and it helped them live through the ice storm.
I don't know if I believe that one. Maybe it was a cow.
That's what they said. And they said the elephants roared like crazy the whole time. And that in Oymakon, Russia, where the average winter temperature is minus 50 degrees, locals refer to vodka as Ruski Chai, which literally translates as Russian tea. So there you have it, some fun Russian vodka facts.
Let's go make ourselves some Ruski Chai. Sounds nice.